Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us on the phone to talk about our first topic is Alex Gafke and David Weaver. Alex is a graduate student in land resources and environmental science at Montana State University. And David Weaver is a professor there at Montana State University in the same department. And we're here to talk about some research they're doing on the tamarisk plant and the tamarisk beetle and some efforts to control this plant. So first, I'll stop there. David and Alex, thanks for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Yeah, if you guys could stay good and close to your speakerphone, we'll appreciate that. It'll knock down some of that echo. Let's start here. Let's get a little background and history on the tamarisk plant. What is it? Where did it come from? And why is it a concern?
So tamarisk, which is also commonly referred to as salt cedar, it was introduced from Asia, so it's a plant that's native to Asia. It was introduced to North America in the early 1800s as an ornamental plant. It has kind of white and pink flowers. It's a really pretty ornamental plant. It was also introduced as a kind of shelter belt plant and to help with erosion control. Since its introduction to the United States, it kind of quickly, rapidly escaped cultivation and then pretty much began spreading across the western United States. It's a plant that primarily occurs along waterways, so you find it mainly in the rivers, along the rivers of the kind of western states, in the wetlands and along reservoirs. And the plant now occupies over 1 million acres. So since its introduction, it has now become very widespread.
Okay, so let's talk about, sounds nice. It's got a nice blossom to it. Maybe it has a fragrance associated. It had an ornamental origins. What's the problem with tamarisk?
So with its introduction and its spread, it's now come into competition with a lot of our native plants, in particular the cottonwoods and the willows that would typically grow along the riverways in the western United States. So with its introduction and spread, it's now the salt cedar is now kind of out-competing and forcing out a lot of our native plants. And it can do that because salt cedar is very well adapted to fire. And it increases fire intensity and frequency in our kind of along the riverways, which our native plants are not well adapted to. It can also kind of, from its name, it can secrete salt that it takes up in the groundwater that it uses for growth and transpiration. So it can deposit a lot of salt around, around itself, which is very detrimental to the native plants. So with kind of this increased competition, increased fire frequency, salt deposition, it results in these big monoculture dense stands of salt cedar. So it can pretty much force out and replace all of the native plants. And when you lose your native plant community, it really degrades any sort of wildlife habitat. So it's not a very ecologically friendly plant in the United States.
So give us a little bit of a picture of efforts that have been made to control this and kind of, you know, what's worked and what hasn't.
So there's, I'd say, probably three main strategies that the United States has deployed for controlling this invasive weed. The first one is going to be physical or mechanical removal. So that's where you pretty much just get a group of people or you get heavy machinery and you go in and you use chainsaws, you cut down the plants, you tear them up by the roots, and you just physically remove the plants from, you know, where they're occupying. It can be very effective at controlling infestations of salt cedar. However, it costs a lot of money. It's very labor intensive and it causes a lot of disturbance to the soil. So when you disturb the soil from removing the salt cedar, a lot of times you can get other weeds that will just come in and replace it. So you're kind of replacing one weed for another when you do mechanical removal. The second strategy is going to be kind of a chemical control. That was kind of one of the, or probably the primary strategy that's been deployed for, you know, years, you know, more than 50 years. And it's kind of gotten lackluster results. It hasn't really stopped the spread of salt cedar. Most of the herbicides are not very effective at controlling it. And like mechanical removal, it can be very costly if you're spraying herbicides on hundreds of thousands of acres. The third strategy, which is the one we do our research on, is going to be biological control. So that's where you use a very host-specific natural enemy, in this case the tamarix beetle, to kind of provide top-down regulation of that targeted invasive weed. So it's going to be kind of a very low-cost control, and it's going to provide kind of landscape-scale control of the plant.
Now, with the tamarisk beetle, is this able to get into more remote areas than some of those, you know, than using the chemical control or the physical control? And I ask about this because many of our listeners probably have hiked into canyons in southern Utah and seen this plant growing, you know, miles and miles from a road.
Yeah, so the beetles are very good at dispersing themselves, and they're very good at finding the salt cedar plant. So, yeah, you can release them, and once their populations kind of start to build up, they will be able to get to all those salt cedar plants that people can't get to, you know, whether trying to having to hike in with a backpack sprayer or trying to, you know, take a four-wheeler or, you know, large machinery to try and remove the plants. So, yeah, biological control is very good about getting to those kind of, you know, hard-to-find weed infestations and exerting some sort of control suppression of those plants.
So what does the beetle do to the plant?
So the beetle, it simply feeds on the plant. It feeds on the plant by kind of scraping and scratching the leaf tissue of the plant, and then they consume the, you know, the stuff that they've scraped off. And what that results in is it kind of scratches off the cuticle of the plant and makes it really hard for the plant to properly regulate water, and then the plant ends up desiccating and all of its foliage dies. So that's how this beetle kind of exerts a control potential over salt cedar.
I'm just curious, is it, does one beetle take care of one plant, or is there a minimum number of, is there a critical number of beetles that are required to take care of an average plant?
Good question. It's going to require multiple beetles. Depending on the size of the plant, you know, if you have a really small plant, you're going to need fewer beetles. Right. A large plant's going to need more. But it's going to, I guess, kind of generally require hundreds, if not thousands, of beetles to foliate a plant. But considering that each one of these females can produce upwards of 200 to 300 eggs, it doesn't take them very long to get a population where you can literally have millions and millions and millions of beetles. So they can, they can really truly produce a army of beetles that can just kind of march through these salt cedar infestations and defoliate everything.
Okay.
So if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Professor David Weaver and grad student Alex Gafke from Montana State University about the invasive plant tamarisk and the ways to manage it here in the western United States. So back to that beetle. Tell us where the beetle came from and when it was introduced.
So the beetle came from Asia, the same place that salt cedar is native to. Specifically, the beetles were collected from northern China and Kazakhstan. They go through a very rigorous vetting process before they're brought over and introduced to the United States. And that's just to make sure that these insects can only feed on the target weed, which is salt cedar. So we really don't have to worry about the insects feeding on any of the other plants, or, you know, kind of switching hosts or anything like that. Mm. So once they go through this multi-year vetting process and it's determined that they're going to have an impact on the weed, there's no point in introducing the insect if it's not going to, you know, bring about some level of control of the weed. Then they go through a long permitting process, and then they're allowed to be introduced into the United States.
All right, so let's talk about your research. So it sounds like we have an answer. We've got an invasive weed, and we have a beetle that specifically eats this weed. What's the problem? What's the challenge?
Yeah, this is David.
Yeah.
In our laboratory, we look at what we call semiochemicals or infochemicals to see how we can facilitate insects communicating with one another. In the case of Diarrhabda, it produces an aggregation pheromone. Diarrhabda is the Latin name for tamarisk beetle.
Okay.
Sound like Professor, don't I?
Yeah.
And Alex is going to tell you a little bit more about that.
So these beetles, when they're in their patches of salt cedar, they like to be around each other. They're very, I guess you could say, gregarious, mm-hmm. and they basically form flocks, almost kind of like birds, and they'll move around in groups and then kind of mass attack a plant all at one point in time.
Mm.
So, and they do that by using the aggregation pheromone. So while the tamarisk beetle is very effective at controlling salt cedar, there's some places in the United States where we aren't seeing very good control potential. I'd say one place in particular is going to be Montana. We don't see very good control potential salt cedar in Montana. So we wanted to see, okay, can we take this aggregation pheromone, which we have synthetic chemists who can produce it, can we put this pheromone out in the field and move the beetles around to areas where we want them to be? So basically, we're trying to be the Pied Piper of these beetles so that we can go out and we can aggregate these beetles onto this particular plant, and then that's where the beetles will show up. And if you can do that, you can take these populations that aren't being very effective and congregate them to kind of a specific area, and then you'll start to get an impact from the insects. So this is a tool that can be kind of deployed in areas where you're seeing suboptimal control of the salt cedar.
Now, why are you seeing better control in some places than others? Is this coming from climate, from, you know, freezes or floods or heat? What impacts the beetle?
There's several things that could be impacting them. One of them that we think kind of in the northern part of its range, in the United States, in like Montana, northern Wyoming, northern Idaho, it's kind of the flood cycle that really prevents these insects from building up very large populations. So if you can use this pheromone to attract the beetles into safe places so that they don't get flooded out from, you know, the river systems, then all of a sudden you can conserve your population so that they have greater growth potential, and then you can get a large population that'll start to defoliate the plant. So there's several reasons why these insects aren't having good control potential, and one of them is probably from kind of climate variables and flooding.
All right, so we're running out of time, and we haven't even gotten to your research yet, but sorry about that, but it's such a fascinating backstory. So your research, I guess, again, looks at the use of this, you call this aggregator pheromone, to, I guess, draw more beetles to more plants, if that's correct. Explain in a nutshell what your research looked at and what the findings were.
So we wanted to first test, okay, can we actually aggregate these beetles where we want them to be?
Hmm.
The kind of results very conclusively showed that, yes, we can. We can increase the densities, you know, like tenfold by putting out the aggregation pheromone.
Hmm.
And then once you aggregate the beetles to a specific plant, they then lay more eggs on that plant. Then you end up with more larvae, which are just the immature beetles on that plant, which results in more damage from the beetles. And then you can really increase the defoliation of those salt cedar plants. And once you've increased the defoliation, that will ultimately end up in greater dieback of the plant and then a reduction of the plant's canopy, basically. So in our research, what we saw is when you applied the aggregation pheromone, you could take plants that, you know, the beetles weren't impacting at all. You could aggregate them there. Then you could increase the dieback from the damage the beetles were doing up to about, you know, 80, 90, 100%. So when you're killing, or when dieback is the kind of the live foliage that dies after the insects have fed on it.
Right.
Once you kill that canopy, the plant really shrinks in size. And we were, you know, taking plants that were 10 feet tall, and after about 2 years of defoliation from the insects, they were just little seedling sizes, about a foot tall. So now all of a sudden land managers can start to, you know, potentially deal with those tiny plants a lot easier than the large plants that weren't previously impacted by the insects.
I get it.
Now, one thing we wanted to touch on just briefly is maybe some of the negative impacts of getting rid of this tamarisk. There's been concern that the Southwest Willow Flycatcher will be negatively impacted by removal of tamarisk. Is this something that you're worried about in making this biocontrol even more effective?
Yes and no. So this is actually going to be a tool that could help conserve, or we're kind of hypothesizing, and this will kind of be the next phase of our research. It could potentially help conserve the salt cedar that the southwestern willow flycatcher is nesting in, because we could put out the aggregation pheromone in these areas to pull the beetles away from the flycatcher so that those insects aren't interacting with the flycatcher. So this could be a tool where, when the flycatcher isn't present, it can, you know, kind of potentiate the insects so that they can start having greater control potential. But when the flycatcher is present, we can pull the beetles away so that they aren't going to be impacting those trees that the bird is nesting in.
So real quick, how is this pheromone applied? Spray or otherwise?
So once it's synthesized, it's just kind of comes in a liquid. It's, I don't know, kind of a, it's like an oily type liquid, kind of has an oil-like consistency. We then put it into a commercial product that is produced by the company ISCA Technologies. So you can find a whole host of commercial products for the specific field application of semiochemicals. The product we use is called Splat. It's kind of this waxy, putty-like substance, and then you can literally, it's loaded into a caulking gun, and then you can just squeeze out a dollop onto a plant, and then that dollop will release the pheromone over time, drawing in the beetles over time, so that you can have, you know, some effective longevity of the application of the pheromone.
That's great. So literally a dollop on a branch or the trunk. It's not like you have to apply a spray to the entire tree or broadcast it in some fashion.
No, I would just walk through the salt cedar stands with a caulking gun and, yeah, just squeeze out a dollop onto branches, and then I'd come and check the next couple, you know, a week later, and I'd find way more insects on those plants because of the application of the pheromone.
Perfect.
Well, we have to wrap up shortly here, but just wanted to quickly ask what's next and when can people get their hands on this product?
Hmm. The product has not been commercialized yet. This is still very much just in kind of the proof of concept phase. So our next step in this research is to really try and develop a way that people can apply it that's more friendly than the method we applied in the paper. In the paper, we had to apply the pheromone every week, which nobody has time to go out every week and treat their salt cedar plants. So we're going to try and develop a method where we can maybe reduce it down to like 3 applications a year instead of 15, 16, 17 applications a year. So we're going to really try to develop it into a more management-friendly type application and see if we can get the same results.
Alex Gafke is a graduate student in Land Resources and Environmental Science at Montana State University, and his advisor is Professor David Weaver Alex, where can people go to get a copy of this paper?
So this paper is it's open access online, so anybody can download it. You would go to the journal Pest Management Science, and you would just kind of search for the title, Semiochemicals to Enhance Herbivory by Diarrhabda crenulata Aggregations and Salt Cedar Infestation.
Yeah, of course, that's so obvious.
I've committed it to memory.
A very straightforward title.
Yeah, why not? You're sounding very professorial yourself there, Alex. Again, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we'll stay in touch to touch base and see how things are going in the future.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.